Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Greetings from the hill country of Central Texas. This is Revolution of Military Affairs, and I'm your host, Amos Fox. All right, welcome back to the Revolution of Military Affairs podcast. Today we have Jeff Meiser. He's the Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Portland, and he's a rock star because he got up super early this morning to meet with me because he's out on the West Coast. I'm in the Central Time Zone, and it's early where I'm at, so it's extremely early there. So, Jeff, thank you very much for your time this morning, and I appreciate you talking with me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I think what we're going to talk about today primarily is strategy. So we've talked a couple times on strategy with a couple different guests, and we've had actually the third rated episode on this podcast series is one of the episodes on strategy. And so I thought it'd be a good time to come back and revisit that point, but just revisit with someone else. And looking back at your CV and everything, I know you've written a lot about it. And in 2017, you wrote this paper that doesn't seem to die, which is a good thing. But it's N plus ways plus means equals bad strategy that was published in Parameters. And so that was where I first came across your work. And so I always found that it was a very thoughtful paper. And then I was just reading a RUSI Journal article the other day, and it was on strategy. And sure enough, you were referenced many times in there. And so I think when something keeps coming up like that, it's important to go to the source and kind of find out the ideas behind that and what they think about whatever topic it is. So today that's strategy. But before we get going, I was looking at your CV again, and I think it's fascinating. So your bachelor's and master's degrees are in no way, shape, or form related to your PhD, at least from somebody looking at it from the outside in. So how did you go from ecological studies and environmental science to political science? Because that really intrigues me.
Yeah. Well, you know, to even add another layer, I started off as a physics major in undergrad. So I went to physics, to ecological studies, to environmental science and management, to then political science. So, you know, I think that, you know, I guess it's when you're 18 or whatever, you don't really know what you want to do or anything, right? So then I thought physics would be like, oh, we'll go in there and we'll talk about like the origins of the universe and the Big Bang and stuff like that. And no, it was like a cannonball is shot with an initial velocity, blah, blah, blah. And then what's the acceleration? I was like, okay, well, I didn't stick with that too long. So then, I don't know, I thought environmental issues was interesting to me, so I got into that. And then it was like my last semester, I think, or a quarter at undergrad that I took environmental politics, and that kind of really captured my interest. But at that point, it was way too late to be a political science major. So then as I moved forward, I just sort of you know, even in my master's degree, it was environmental science and management, but I took policy classes and as many as I could. And then I just realized that's what I wanted to do. And at first I was like, oh, well, I want to do environmental policy and politics. And then, you know, 9/11 happened and that kind of, like a lot of people kind of shocked my brain. And then I thought, well, what's actually going on in the world more broadly? And so I kind of broadened my perspective and got interested in all sorts of stuff. And then I did international relations, you know, Johns Hopkins for my PhD, yeah. And that sort of all came together kind of in that way.
I thought that was just a very fascinating circle, because it's one of those things too, like my bachelor's and master's are in secondary education. I was going to teach high school before 9/11 happened, and then all that happened, and you know, things change. And right. So it's one of those things where I always find it like, what's the good story here? And I think that that's that's an interesting story. So with that, so again, like I said, you've written quite a bit about strategy, and so I guess just to kick it off, what is strategy and why is strategy important?
So my definition of strategy is that a strategy is a theory of success. And obviously that's related to the idea of theory of victory, or in other realms, let's say theory of change. So I think that's, I was kind of inspired by that kind of thinking. And, you know, actually is kind of suggested by the article title that you mentioned, is that when I first approached the area of strategy, I was told the definition is, you know, strategy is ends, ways, and means.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I first countered that at when I was teaching at National Defense University, and I kind of was dropped in there without, as they call me, a chemically pure civilian, and I didn't really, I hadn't
thought
about.
Sure, that was
eye-opening.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of just like trying to figure out what was going on for a while. And we were just like, okay, well, here, you are going to teach the strategies, ends, ways, and means. Like, okay, that's, I'll just go into that, right? And then pretty quickly I got uncomfortable with that, and I didn't really know why. And I sort of like read more and thought about it more, and I kind of, using the work of others definitely a lot to kind of get to that point of strategy is a theory of success. And what I was just searching for is, I watched, you know, hundreds of presentations from military officers from around the world, you know, they're at NDU, and they were, you know, having like PowerPoint slides with arrows, with, you know, lines of effort, and they were aiming at either a goal or at the enemy. And, you know, and I was like, okay, that looks cool. But then at the end, I was like, what makes them think they're actually going to do anything, or going to change anything, right, or make anything better, or achieve anything? That was never, it was never explained, you know, because usually it was also like,
that's the big arrow. That's what makes you think that.
Yeah, it's usually doing more of the same is sort of what it ended up being a lot of. And I was like, okay, so how is, and I had great mentors too. And I would talk to them about like, hey, like what's going on? They're like, yeah, how are you going to change anything? How are you going to make things better if you're just doing the same stuff and you're not explaining, like, what's the causation here? And so I thought, when I was, you know, rereading some of Barry Posen's work and stuff, and I was like, oh, you know, he's using the word theory. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense, because, well, what is strategy? It has to be, has to have like a synonym or something that's meaningful that you can say to describe it, you know? And so theory made sense to me, and you're trying to cause something to happen. And then I like Stephen Walt's definition of theory is just a causal explanation. I'm like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. So, yep. A theory is a causal explanation. A strategy is explaining how you're going to cause success to happen. And so that just really made intuitive sense to me. Like when I got to that point, I was like, yeah, that finally makes sense. You have to explain how you're going to cause success to happen. And then the idea of theory of victory has been around for a long time. And then, but as I was reading like other sets of literature, I was like, well, is victory really the right word? Sometimes you're just trying to make things less bad, or you have, there's a variety of objectives you're going for. And so what can you put in there as a word that makes sense? Success, maybe not ideal, but that seemed to me that was better than victory. And I also had this idea in my head that you should have a definition of strategy, like a starting point definition of strategy that fits any situation, like business, nonprofit, politics, military. Like you should have strategy is relevant to all those fields. So you should have a definition of strategy that fits everywhere. right? And so I had kind of all those ideas going around in my head, and then, okay, well, here's a definition that makes sense to me and fits all these criteria. And so that's, to me, it just made sense. And as I've gone forward since then, you know, that's, you know, we're almost 10 years on probably since I really first thought of this, it still makes the most sense to me, you know? Yeah. And I think the point of like, why is it important? I think that definition also kind of highlights that point too, is why is it important? And a key thing for me is that a definition should be analytically useful. Mm-hmm. Right? It should help you do the work. Right? Yeah. It should set you up for being able to do the work, whatever that work is, that intellectual work. So first off, I guess the claim of strategy is that if you have a good strategy, it increases your effectiveness. Right, that's a main point. And how you can prove that, I mean, that's kind of a different kind of digression maybe to go, but that's the starting point proposition. And so then the question can be like, how do you have a good strategy? How do you know it's good? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe after the fact, if things are working out, okay, well, maybe that was a good strategy.
Yeah.
But then again, you can't say just because there's a good outcome is caused by a good strategy. That's right. Not how things work.
Yeah, there's chance and all sorts of other things factor into that.
Yeah, tons of things you don't know, right? So, yep. But you can kind of look in, you can kind of study from the retrospective kind of perspective and say, well, was it strategy or did it work? Did it cause things we wanted to? But you also want to know ahead of time, is the strategy good before you implement it? Mm-hmm. And that's really difficult to know. It's extremely difficult. But if you're thinking in terms of theories, like there's a whole philosophy of science and social science methods that can help you try and think about whether or not a theory is a good theory or not. And so yeah. I thought that would also help in terms of thinking through what is a strategy? How do you know if you have a good strategy before you implement it? And then looking backwards, what's a useful way for analyzing strategy? If you want to know, hey, was this a good strategy that happened, whatever, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or like an ongoing strategy? You can use these methods to evaluate, oh, is this strategy good or not? And so I think for all those reasons, I think that's the best definition that I know of. And I think it's useful.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I think that one of the things that jumps out at me too when you talk about strategy, especially in that paper, and I'm not going to focus on the paper entirely, or even like with a majority of this conversation, but I'm just going to tie it back to that real quick. But it reminded me a lot of Everett Dolman's book, Pure Strategy, and I don't know if you've read that or not, but it struck me. But I find Dolman's almost like it's too far evolved from a conceptual standpoint. It's like a rich man's version of strategy. And for those who haven't read Dolman, essentially it's that winning is irrelevant, tactical winning is irrelevant, and that the goal of a strategist is to just stay in the game and keep the game continuing to be played. And if the game ever ends, it's actually bad strategy because then they're no longer at the table playing the game. And so, you know, like you could take that a million different directions. Open-ended conflicts are beneficial, right? That could be one of the arguments there. And so when I read that paper, when I read your, and after having read his book, because we had to read that when I went to Sam's, that was one of the key texts we read in the portion of the course on strategy. And it blew my mind when I first read it. And then I'd read your paper not long after that, because your paper came out not too long after that. And I felt like there was very not a ton of overlap, but there was some conceptual overlap. So thoughts on that?
Yeah. No, I mean, I like it up to a point, but his reluctance or avoidance of thinking through what outcomes you're trying to get to is kind of troubling because. It's sort of like the same issue I kind of have with emergent strategy. Like that idea is that, if ahead of time you don't set up any kind of goals or any vision of success, then how do you know you're ever getting close to it? Yeah. Like the assessment evaluation piece are you doing it well or not? 'Cause you always say like, oh, hey, I'm staying in the competition here. You know, I'm staying in the game. So I'm winning. Right? Like you're like, well, that's not really satisfying. 'Cause then you can just use that to, kick the can down the road to not have any accountability. Yep. Same with emergent strategy. At least one vision of it is that, well, if it's, you know, it's like, oh, what's your strategy? Like, you can just say, well, hey, it's emergent, man. It's just happening all around you.
When it comes to me, it comes to me. You know, we're gonna, yeah. That's so what I always. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was gonna say that it's. That's why I think it's important to say, you know, strategy is a noun. It's a theory. It's a thing you can tell people what like someone says, what's your strategy? You can tell them, you know,
yeah.
And that's the only way you can have accountability or know if you're doing well is you have to be able to articulate it. And, you know, it can, yeah, sure. Emergent, it can change, it can evolve, but I think you have to be clear about, okay, it's evolving from this to this and now it's this thing. And, you know, if next week or in next year, whatever, it has to evolve again, you say what it is again. And you make it better, but yeah.
Well, I think that's like anything. You should always be revisiting what it is. You know what I mean? Both what you're doing, both the strategy that's guiding what you're doing, and updating it as you go. Like to me, strategy is not some locked thing that just never changes. And so that's one of the things too that I find that like you should always be updating your strategy. But back to Dolman really fast. Yeah, that when I first read that book, it like completely like it was like one of those things that turned my mind inside out, you know, and I was like, what is he saying? And I felt like early on, it was like I had this like very negative reaction to it. I was like, no, this doesn't compute. And then later I was like, man, this is terrific. He's totally on it. And then I was in, I reread it when I was working in Iraq the last time. I worked at Sejflick, the Land Component Command, during the fight against ISIS for the last couple months of the Battle of Mosul and then afterwards. And I was like, I feel like we're living this, like this Dolman strategy, you know, and I had like charted this little thing. But then I was like, is this accidental? You know, are we accidentally stumbling our way through a Dominion strategy? Or is this intentional? Is this thing open-ended because we're just not good at strategy, or is it open-ended because we're trying, like, this is the strategy, you know? And so I bring that up to ask my next question of you, and what makes a good strategist?
Good strategist. Well, so, I mean, I think that an important part of it is that, you know, you have the right definition to start with. And then I think the way of thinking, the appropriate way of thinking to me is scientific way of thinking, and people get all in their feelings about that sometimes. They want to say, well, strategy is an art and a science or whatever. And I really dislike that.
the way of thinking, that's good, like, because that's where I'm going next. So this is good.
Cause it's like, dude, what's art? Can you define art for me? Yeah. It's a creative endeavor. Well, what's science? You know, you think that science is not creative? The scientific methodology is just like, think about the wheel of science is you know, you develop a hypothesis, you test it, you revise it, right? That's science, right? You have a theory, you have a hypothesis, and you test it according to real world evidence, right? So to me, that's the strategist mindset too. You know, to be a good strategist is to have that mindset. And, you know, it's not like, you're some kind of robot that develops hypotheses and tests. It's like you're a creative individual that's developing theories and hypotheses and finding creative ways to test them and understand if they're working or not. So it's extremely creative. So science is definitely a creative process. So you don't have to say, you're trying to say, oh, well, strategy is creative. You don't have to put art in there to designate it. It's a science.
Yeah, it's almost implied,
Yeah, and then I think people also get worried, like science means it's just, you know, quantitative, or it's, I don't know, that you're just crunching numbers and that's all it is. And that's also not true, you know? So I think having that mindset where, the core of strategy is creating causal effects, like the causal effects that you want, like you're trying to cause something, right? And that has to be at the heart of it. And so that has to be your way of thinking is, okay, how am I going to cause the outcomes that I want? It could be, hey, I want to make things slightly better. I want to achieve something big, whatever it is, like you want to have a causal effect. So how are you going to do that? That's the toughest thing in the world to do. Right?
Yeah.
How are you going to cause something to happen in like this crazy world with all these factors and luck and chance and all this stuff? And you're actually going to cause something to happen. That's intense, you know?
Too is like, you're also like, when we think about it in the context of war and warfare, you're doing that in an adversarial context where somebody's applying resources against you to do the same thing for themselves, you know? And so it's, that's one of the things when I think about this, I think, you know, going back to your arrows, we draw this nice straight line arrow across the board saying, you know, we're starting at our current state. We're going to this end state or this desired future state or whatever the phrase is we want to use for it, you know? And one of the things I've always liked to do is, you know, you draw that end state. This is my ideal goal here, but then you need to draw like a sub-optimized goal and then draw a droopy arrow and say, this is really where we're probably going because of that adversarial context, right? Because there's so many factors actually working against you and not helping you. Because the only thing that's really helping you is you and whatever friend you have, but like everything else is working against you. So I think that that's one of the things that often gets looked over when we're thinking about strategy and good strategists.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's definitely true. And then, so then part of that way of thinking and the scientific method is then in response to this is revisiting your hypothesis. So you're testing it, you're seeing if it's working, probably it's partially working at any given time. And then, so you're revising it again and you're going through that process. So to me, that's an important part of being a strategist. And it suggests you have to be open to like self-critique, critique from others, because you're trying to improve your strategy as much as you can, your hypothesis, your theory. Yeah. And so you're stress testing it, and you're part of that debate where others are doing that too, ideally, and so that your goal is to make it better. So you're really putting it through that wheel of science. Okay, is this going to work? Or is this working? Okay, it's not working quite good enough. We're going to try again. We're going to keep, you know, going through that process. So you have to have that mindset.
I'm about to, I get a little twitchy when I hear you talking about this because I get going back to when I last worked in Iraq, the strategy was assessed. There was an assessments working group or whatever periodically. And it was done at, I don't know if it went below us or not, but it certainly happened where I was at the land component in Iraq, and then it occurred above us too. And, you know, you're measuring success by these quantifiable things, you know, did this happen, yes or no? And that's fine. But then, like, what I noticed was when you started getting the answer that you didn't want to get, you just turned off the meeting, right? And then the meeting... They would start getting canceled, and then they just were completely canceled altogether. And so we had these orises just sitting there for the rest of that time. Operations, research, and systems analysis folks, who are, you know, the people that ran this assessments working group, that just sat there and didn't do anything the rest of the time. And so your comment about being honest with yourself and, you know, assessing yourself and assessing your strategy, that one like really resonates with me because I was, you know, as you watch this happen, you're like, what we're doing what? Oh, we don't care anymore. Okay, cool. So, and then it goes back to like that comment on Dominion strategy. Are we doing that on purpose? Or are we stumbling our way through it? Because at that point we were essentially doing a, you know, Dolman approach to strategy. So your comments on science are perfect because I wanted to ask you about the future of strategy. All right. And so I guess I have a bit of a two-part question here. So part one, and then I'll come back and restate part two once we get through part one, but I'll say them both up front. So the future strategy. So with artificial intelligence and machine learning, how do you think that will impact strategy moving forward into the future? Will it become just will it remove the human element? Will it make it just this binary choice of pick A or B and like the whole strategic process is done algorithmically within a computer? And then, you know, the idea of the strategist is not really a thing. We have, instead of, you know, the Mac 2, it's the Clausewitz 2, you know, you just change the name of the computer to Clausewitz. So you move from that. And then part two of this question is, so with the proliferation of drones and long range fires, proxy forces, and the unwillingness to put boots on the ground in so many parts of the world while still being engaged in armed conflict in so many parts of the world, How is that reshaping, or is it reshaping strategy? And is it turning, this is my favorite question, is it turning strategy into a strategy of strike? So there you go. Bunch of questions there.
Okay. So on the AI piece and strategy, my engagement with like those technologies has been sort of through student papers, like to the extent that they use that, and I discover it and so on in papers. And so I'd say that thus far I'm not that impressed in terms of what they produce in terms of like thoughtful analysis. And I mean, the machines kind of have a reluctance to kind of make choices, it seems like. So like often ask questions like, oh, here's two theories, which one's better? And you know the AI ones, because they're like, oh, who can say? I'm like, okay. You're supposed to say that's the question.
That's the question,
But the AI is like, I cannot say, you know?
Yeah.
So right now there's obviously, I think, limitations, although, of course, there's higher end and no AI and stuff like that. So I think there's some that's better than others, and I can't speak to what's the best cutting edge, but I think it does get to the point of, I'll just say, I was recently reading an article about how AI might replace like middle management of corporations and stuff like that. The white collar jobs might, some of them might go out the window.
Yeah.
And the claim in the article, like, oh, well, you know, because AI is good at critical thinking, and so you don't need people to do that. I just started laughing because that's not been my experience at all. That's the thing that AI is worst at, is like critical thinking. It can compile and synthesize things, but then
a judgment. Yeah.
Yeah, can't make a judgment. It can't. I don't think it can really conceptualize what's actually a good critique versus just like, oh, here are critiques that exist that I can generate. You know.
Yeah.
So I also ask those kind of questions on for students and be like, hey, well, what's the strongest criticism you have of this argument? And then if it's AI, it's like it'll be some very generic thing, you know, that they can just find out in Wikipedia or something, whatever land, you know. And so I don't know. I don't know exactly where the trend line is going, but I'm not thinking that's the AI is going to replace strategists or strategic thinking. I think part of what it can do, like, so part of how I understand and think about strategy is that you should ahead of time, if you can, test like both the internal validity and external validity of your theory. So does it make sense internally? Is it logical? That kind of thing. And then also, what evidence out there do you have that you can use to test this theory? Like, are there other cases that are kind of like this, or is there any kind of quantitative information you can use to test your theory ahead of time to have any sense of like, oh, would this type of strategy work in this type of situation? Something like that.
Yeah.
So then at that point, AI is probably very useful. You know, computer, tell me all the relevant cases of this in the world or something like that, you know? And be able to just like compile stuff. I think that's probably going to be quite useful. But in terms of like, hey, tell me how I can successfully cause blank to happen. I'm not thinking that's going to be, you know, a easy thing for AI to kind of take over that kind of thinking. But again, who knows?
Yeah, that's one of the trends in a lot of thinking, a lot of military circles, is the idea that we're going to use AI to help with automated decision making and automated like computer aided assistance like CAD for the decision making, essentially, you know. And that's something that is being pushed really hard right now for development. And it's just an interesting thing, because I think, again, conceptually I can understand it, but I don't know that realistically it's got the nuance to understand, maybe at least yet, the unique situations that may arise and the judgments that have to apply. I'm fearful of the killer robot army, and I don't know that it's going to be able to make sound decisions.
I think that, I guess the other side of it, as you're talking, I was just thinking is that, well, we're not necessarily doing a great job right now. So maybe AI, even though AI is not going to do great either, it's like, well, we're not awesome at it. So who knows?
That'll get to my last question. But my next one is the follow-up. The drones, long-range fire proxies, What does that say? Where are we at with that in terms of, you know, strategic thinking? How is that? Is that short circuiting? It's almost an easy button in many regards.
Yeah. So I think the alternative to strategy is just to say, hey, we have these tools, let's just use them.
Yeah.
Right. And so this is one of I think my critiques of U.S. way of strategy is that it's often means based, and that language of ends waste means of like, hey, we have a pile of resources. How are we going to direct that? And so the strategy piece is just like, oh, okay, I have this stuff I can use. I'm just going to put it on the problem, you know? So the debates, if you look back to like the Obama surge and stuff like that, the debate is like, well, it's how many troops to send, not it's less about what they're going to do. You know, there was some of that debate too, but it's more, ends up being that's kind of short circuited. Even the discussion of at least the accounts I've read about that the debate was like within like the first hour, it's like, are we gonna stay and do something? Okay, we decided that in like 5 minutes, and then it comes really quickly. Like, okay, so we're gonna use either put 30,000 or 70,000 or whatever on it. And then also the debates about the campaign against ISIS. At least in the news reporting stuff, it's all about what platforms are used, what weapon systems, you know, and it's less about, oh, okay, what's really going on there? And they're using
the precision dog whistle is one of my favorites.
Right. So saying that what I think is that it's been a tradition in the US, like way of strategy for a long time, is just to put resources on the problem and think less about how exactly they're used. So I think this is precision strike, drones, that tends to be also just like you're, I think, suggesting, is kind of a stand-in for strategy in that we just apply tools and we're not really thinking about the strategy piece. It's kind of implicit. And this is
that's exactly what I was going to say. It's like the strategy and the goodness of it's implicit. And you should understand when we say we're using precision strike, you should understand that it's better and it's going to do a good job, you know?
Yeah. And I think in one of your previous guests, I think, suggested that, you know, precision strike was a strategy. And then in talking about it, I
appreciate you calling me out for that, by the way. I can't push too far, you know?
And so I think that what was meant by that is I think denial was the strategy and then precision strike was the tool.
Yep.
But then I think what's important there is like, well, you have to ask, well, why denial? I mean, why not something else? And what other ways can you cause denial to happen? You know, so if you're kind of locked into, okay, we have these tools that can cause this thing. Well, then I guess that's our strategy. So you kind of walk backwards into it like, hey, we have these tools.
The goal.
Yeah. So you have the tools first, and you're like, okay, so then what kind of things can we do with this? Okay, then that becomes the strategy. And instead of thinking through ahead of time, well, what we're actually going to think through is, here's the range of strategy options. We're going to choose one because it's best, and then we're going to align that with the resources we have in whatever kind of process you like to have there. And then if it's just always implicit, then again, it comes back to you can't test it. You can't think it through effectively if it's implicit. And that's why another reason I don't like the kind of emergent approach, which suggests that maybe, you know, the implicit sort of tacit strategy is okay because you're like learning by doing and so on. But to me, again, it's like, you don't know if you're successful, you don't know, there's no accountability at the end. So, and it's the same thing with tools, like, oh, hey, we use these tools, that maybe that means we're doing it right or that kind of thing. And so.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites.
So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's challenging there. And I'm teaching this class, American Way of War, right now. And I was introducing them to the Hellfire missile that doesn't explode, that with like the sword blades on it.
Oh, yeah.
They were totally fascinated by the existence of that.
Isn't that what we took out that guy in Iraq with like 2 weeks ago?
This is why. And the Wall Street Journal had like an exclusive where like, oh, this is how he died, you know?
Yeah.
And so we're talking about the American Way of War of like, hey, you know, it's casualty sensitivity and humanitarian norms and stuff like that. And I was like, the U.S. military went to the, I don't know who developed it exactly, but they went to the extreme of, we want to be so careful about killing people that we're going to have a sword missile, you know?
Yeah.
They're just like, whoa, kind of blew their minds that somebody somewhere in a room was like, oh, hey, what if we just put sword blades on it, you know?
Yeah. It's like a little samurai. It's like a little samurai sword pops out and.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, we have these weapon systems that then give us capabilities. And so we're just thinking, okay, well, we have this capability. This must be the right way to do it, you know? And it kind of, like I said, you know, the tail wagging the dog or whatever you want to kind of call it.
Yeah. I think it does have, it gets the way you do or should think about policy out of whack for sure. And I think there's a lot of this, and I've mentioned this before, and I put it in a couple things I've written. I got into this conversation one time when I was in Baghdad. This is a few months after Mosul, and there was a British army officer working with us in there. And we were chatting one night because this is when I was doing some like analytical, you know, assessments of what was going on for my own personal benefit. And we were talking about the Battle of Mosul, right? The city was flattened, you know, but we used like not exclusively, but just a massive amount of precision strike munitions, whether it was MLRS delivered, you know, Hellfires from Apaches, whatever the case may be. And, you know, so we're having this debate and I'm like, yeah, but like, would it have just been cheaper and perhaps even quicker if we would have just used, you know, ballistic artillery, you know? And then he kept coming back to, no, but we used precision. And I'm like, but does it matter? Because the city was flattened either way, you know? And it was like there's this bias to precision munitions, regardless of the outcome, right? Regardless of if it actually does something better or not better than what you would get if you just used a, you know, non-precision munition or non-precision delivery, you know, capability. Mm-hmm. And it's just this fascinating thing because you see it. It's got this dog whistle quality to it where it's like, you know, the Wizard of Oz, don't look behind the curtain, you know, right. Like just listen to the fact that we said it's precision strike. Yeah, and that's one of the things that I find really interesting about this whole thing when we talk about drones and long-range fires and all that is that one of the other things that I think when you were talking, I kept thinking about, we get this whole thing out of whack in many regards, but part of it too, I think, is, you know, if your policy is out of line or exceeds what's actually feasible, then like, does it even matter that your your strategy's out of whack? Because your policy goals, which, you know, you pull that down and those become your strategic goals, mm-hmm. like those actually aren't attainable. And so then you just get into the world of, well, we know we can't actually do this, so we're just gonna do stuff.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that probably explains a lot.
Yeah, I mean, when you look back at like Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, making these beacons of democracy in places where that's not actually probably going to happen, at least not by our doing, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, well, we're just going to go out and drive around and get blown up for 10 years until, you know, somebody finally sends us home.
Yeah.
Hey, no hard feelings on my end, you know, we all got jobs to do and I made it home. Okay. All right. Yeah. So last thing here, since we're getting short on time, what is we've danced around this and kind of touched on it a little bit, but what is the current state of strategy, both from like, you know, just from a strategist perspective, do we have any good strategists today? Do we have good strategies today? And just what is the state of strategic thought in your opinion? And I think to a degree, the question may be a little off kilter based off what you said at the very beginning about strategy conceptually being applicable across the board to anything. So I'm thinking more in terms of like, you know, policy, armed conflict, all that. So floor is yours.
So it's interesting because people sometimes ask like, well, what's the best strategy book or who's the best person to read? And I kind of struggle with that because it's just challenging because, and I think it's like, I often will go to like business strategy books because that's where, I mean, I think it's a more open-ended discussion of like, what is strategy and what's in the broadest sense. And how are you trying to achieve things? Because like in the corporate world, like there's a lot of different tools people use, and it's more, I think, wide open to thinking about different approach to strategy and that kind of thing. So I'll kind of go in that direction. And so there's not a lot of great stuff out there, I don't think. And I think that actually, especially like in the military strategy realm, it's extremely underdeveloped, to kind of put it in academic phrasing there, is that like basic concepts, I think, are just not put under like the rigor and scrutiny that like academic concepts have been. And that can go way too far and really just get into thinking in discussions that are not useful. But I think there's a more optimal place where I think thinking on strategy in the national security and military arena just hasn't gotten to. And a lot of, I think there's significant problems there. And I was just like, I was reading, or I was like, listening to the audiobook of Nolan's, The Allure of Battle.
Oh yeah. Terrific.
And I was like, wow. How do I put this? I'm not, the framing of it is very, challenging for me. And the argument is very challenging in the sense of, to me, I feel like the whole setup is just a series of straw men, and the execution and the definition of what of like decisive battle, just to kind of give the background right, is that, well, decisive battle doesn't really happen, right? It's just, it ends up being like whatever side has the most resources, societal resources they can sort of bring to bear, they win, essentially. I think that's my take on the argument, at least. I think that, you know, if putting like my political science hat on, like what's a decisive battle, and this is, my thinking is kind of also affected by like the Battle of Kyiv. Okay.
Yeah.
People call that decisive. Like, people use the word decisive a lot in Ukrainian conflicts, right?
Yeah.
It's like every day. It's like, I was listening to some podcast, someone said, oh, this is the real phase of battle that's going to determine. Yeah. And then the host is like, well, you said that every single year, like, you know, or every 6 months you say that, right?
And a lot of these analysts out there just have to speak in hyperbole, though, to get the clicks and the downloads. So
right. This is the real decisive moment. So, you know, if you say that a decisive battle is something that determines the outcome of a war, I mean, that's a pretty high standard. Right?
Yeah.
So you're almost defining it out of existence.
And
realizing that, of course, yes. In the past, like 200 years ago, did people think that there could be decisive battle that won the war, and it could have maybe actually happened? Yeah, I mean, maybe. But nobody argues that now. I mean, not that I know of, right?
Yeah.
And so then what's a better way to think about, you know, decisive battle is, what if it just shapes like the next phase, right? So the Battle of Kyiv was decisive in deciding that Russia would not be successful in its initial war plan. Okay. So if you think about maybe in terms of like path dependence, a branching point, the jargon of political science is a critical juncture. So each major battle is a critical juncture that closes off some outcome. Most major battles are going to be decisive in the sense of creating a new pathway, right? Yep. There's a branching point there. So the fact that Kyiv didn't fall, it was decisive in the sense of, hey, Russia was not going to walk to victory, you know, walk to easy victory. It's going to be a different kind of battle. It's going to be a different kind of war after that point. Or go back in history. Like, so was the D-Day landing, the Battle of Normandy or whatever, was that decisive? Well, it was decisive in the sense of setting up a battle for Europe on the land in northern France. Yeah. Whereas if it failed, I'm not saying it would have said, well, you know, Germany wins that battle and therefore wins the war. That's not what would have happened. Yeah. Right. But that would have been a very different history, right? Oh, yeah. If the landing fails, something else happens, right? So you can go through and any major battle you look at is decisive in some way. It's just not, it's not deciding the end of the war, but it's putting the war on a different path than otherwise would be, right? So I mean, that's just an example of, and I mean, I don't want to critique people too harsh or whatever, but yeah. That everybody, every single person in the world loved that book when it came out. And basically we're saying, yes.
I still love that book. It's one of my favorites. Absolute favorites. So I'm actually glad to hear somebody critiquing it, because I'm like a fanboy for that book and absolutely love it. So keep going, because this is,
yeah,
we'll have to have another conversation at a later time to debate the merits of the book, but keep going.
Yeah. 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 So everybody loved it and just accepted it as true. And it's like, okay, well, all these things have to be, you know, scrutinized and, you know, rigorously to think it through. Like, now, so I think that the arguments of Nolan are accurate, more or less, but I mean, I think the framing and the way of thinking it through is there's some serious problems there, I think. I mean, what I like about it is that I think that it's more like a zeitgeisty vibey thing that's out there, yeah. Of like, oh, that there are genius generals that can win a battle and have a quick war and end it all right away and it's over. I think that's something that lives in the minds of probably generals and certain political leaders, sure. And such. And if you look at, again, the Russian war plan was something along those lines of like, hey, we can have a quick victory. We can decapitate.
They had Gerasimov. You know what I mean? That's all you need.
Hey. Yeah, exactly. The genius. So I think that the idea is out there. I think it's the claim that actually like scholars or thoughtful practitioners believe that, I think, is not accurate. But I think it is sort of in the minds of some military planners and maybe even political leaders and like the public at large that, yeah, you can do this. And I think the quick victory disease is the biggest issue. Oh, right. Yeah. And that the assumption that you can end it quickly, that's maybe the more problematic idea. And I think that's the point I think that resonates with me from Nolan is that piece, you know.
Yeah.
But because I mean, what I didn't like from the start about that argument is that, so I think this strategy matters. I think the strategists matter. And yeah. So I think that it's not just whoever has the most stuff that wins. I think that it's also affected by who has the best strategy. So that made me kind of like question it from the start when I first heard of the argument. And so, well, if it's only the resources and application of resources, then strategy doesn't matter that much either. The genius general doesn't matter. The immaculate battlefield victory doesn't matter. And so strategy like also doesn't matter. Yeah. And so in thinking in that way, that's what made me kind of question it a little bit, because I believe strategy matters. I spent a lot of time on it. So I didn't want it to be true that strategy wouldn't matter. You know, I was like, no, that can't be right.
Yeah.
And so that got me thinking about it in kind of a critical way. And so then, I think that. You have to think about these concepts a little maybe differently or subject it to more scrutiny. Also, like the idea of what is strategy, the fact that people will, you know, be out there and come on your show and sort of say, well, hey, it's just a way of thinking about the future or something like that. And I'm like, man, that's not going to work, right? I guess some people don't like my definition because it's too narrow feeling or there's something about it that's uncomfortable. And it's, I guess, narrowness, or I would say clarity. People don't like the clarity, and it also forces you to think clearly and articulate it clearly. And I add this exercise in my classes too, where it's like we take an argument from a book or an article, or we look at maybe what happened in reality, and we say, okay, well, what's the theory of success here? And it's kind of hard to find it sometimes because people. They don't want to get pinned down, you know? This kind of definition, it pins people down and forces them to say, well what are you going to do to cause the effects you want? And why do you think that's going to actually work? people are uncomfortable with that. And so I think that we don't scrutinize our ideas that much, as much as we should in sort of the national security strategy realm. I think it starts with the fact that we don't think rigorously about what strategy is, that people can write articles without, you know, defending their understanding of strategy. And that, you know, we just haven't gotten to that stage where we're really digging into what our basic ideas are. Are they correct? What are all other ways of thinking about it? And I just think, like, there's not that many great, like, literature reviews or, like, review articles on, like, strategy and military strategy. And it's just not something that's done very often, I think. So my problem there is that we need to do more work and think more rigorously about all of our concepts and what we're doing. And so that's an issue. I think it can get better quickly if we just try harder.
That's terrific. I think that one of your things, we don't do it well. We don't think through things well. We don't articulate things well, and we don't want to be boxed in, I think, are key takeaways from that. And I think a large part of the issue on the military side is our jargon binds us, right? We're bound to this box that is our jargon. And, you know, if you don't speak in the language of your system to those within your system, you sound incompetent, right? But if the language in your system is limiting, right, and it's not allowing you to effectively articulate what it is you're trying to do, but you're only communicating in that language, you're automatically operating in this inverted pyramid where you can't really articulate what it is you're trying to do, but what you're trying to do is up out here. And I think that that's a big part of the problem. And then certainly, I think really a larger part of the problem is what you said about the people not wanting to be boxed in, right? Because nobody wants to be the loser. You know, it's easy to be the strategist who wins, but it's hard to be the person where they're like, hey, you said the goal was this and we didn't do this. So, you know, you're out, or you're, you know, the history of your time in command of this thing, or it, you know, is going to be written poorly. And it's, you know, everybody's pining to be the next Bonaparte, you know, scoring their Austerlitz. But in reality, that's, you know, probably a pipe dream these days. And so two last points, because I think that was, you hit on a couple of my internal personal, like, triggers. So the decisive thing, I absolutely love that, because I hate that word and the way it's used today, right? For the exact same reasons you just mentioned. And I don't know what your feelings are on the two dudes I'm going to mention, but I'm going to mention them because I think their ideas are very helpful in some regards, and some regards are not. But so Liddell Hart, in his book, The Ghost of Napoleon, he writes about this very idea, right? So The Ghost of Napoleon's published in 1926, and he talks about the way the word decisive is used and how it's used incorrectly for the same reasons you just laid out. And basically, you know, he's like, you know, the book's about Napoleon. He's, you know, he says, you know, Napoleon's not riding around on his horse out there saying this is the decisive point. All that word is a post facto word, right?
Yeah.
And what Napoleon was probably saying at the time is there's a, you know, the chance for great success if we succeed here. There's an opportunity point here. And so perhaps it's better to speak in terms of opportunity points or opportunity, you know, whatever the other word is there, instead of decisive, right? And so I think that's something, you know, that I really, when I'd always thought that. And then when I read that book when I was in the Command and General Staff College, just I'd seen it actually, The Makers of Modern Strategy, the original book. So we have to read that, you know, big portions of that in the course, but the original book that was published in the 50s, it's actually slightly different. And the chapter on Napoleon in there is heavily critical of, or not of Napoleon, on Clausewitz, is heavily critical of Clausewitz. Whereas the chapter in the one that was published in whatever it was, the 80s or 90s. I keep looking at my bookshelf to make so I was thinking maybe it was on the spine of the book, but it's not. You know, but that one that we had to read in the course, the chapter on Clausewitz is like far more, you know, the normal stuff that people say about Clausewitz. He's great. He's this, is that. Whereas the one that was published in the 50s was very, you know, Clausewitz wasn't all this great, and it had all this, you know, all these, you know, critical analysis of him. And one of the lines in that in that chapter said something to the effect of, you know, World War I generals were drunk on the blood red wine of Clausewitzian growth. Mm. And I thought, what a terrific line. Where did that come from? And so I looked at the footnote and it was The Ghost of Napoleon. And I was like, I've got to read this book based off that one quote taken out of it. And so anyway, that's the big takeaway is, you know, he was very critical of this idea of decisiveness. And I think the other point with that, building on that, so J.F.C. Fuller, the idea of decisiveness, when he talks about decisiveness, and I think this is the more traditional old recollection of the idea, is that it causes either a change in political decision, hence the word decisive, mm-hmm. you know, based off that root, or a change in the military plan. Okay. And so it's either a change in the political situation, you know, you quit, you know, whatever the case may be, as it relates to the political decisions, or it causes a change in a military plan. And so, like you said, it's that pathway dependency thing, right? It causes branches to open up or close depending on what's done there. And I think that today when we use that word, I hate it. Because we just, it sounds cool, you know what I mean? Like, oh, this is decisive. And everybody, I used to have a battalion commander when I was like a lieutenant and baby captain. And he was like one of those pound the tables when he says decisive guys. This is the decisive operation, you know? And I think everybody wants to do that. And they want to be able to throw that word around like they're the HMFIC of, you know, whatever it is that's going on. And really, you're probably not. You're probably just some like minuscule aspect of something very large that you have very little control over. And so the decisiveness, every time I use it, when I use it, I try and tie it to J.F.C. Fuller's definition. It's either a change in the political situation or it's a change in the military plan. A change, in most of those cases with the military plan, it's a phase change, right? So like you said, Battle of Kiev. It was decisive, sure, if we want to use that word, only in that it created an alternative future that, you know, Russia certainly wasn't anticipating. And that Kyiv, like, you know, and the government and military there in Ukraine, that was the whole point of it, was to create that alternative situation. And so, anyway, that's it. I absolutely hate that word. So, for all these reasons, and I really appreciate that that you picked it up. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I just say it gets to the point that I think is consistent more or less with Nolan's argument. Perhaps that, I mean, with strategy broadly, is I think a lot of times what you're doing is trying to like move the needle in a more positive direction, right? So it's not the idea. I mean, maybe I need to revise this. Maybe success isn't the right word, but it's like, maybe this is sort of like what Dolman's getting at too, is like, you're just trying to move it in a slightly more advantageous direction, right?
Yeah.
And if you can get that, I mean, that's, so you should be, and maybe this gets into the idea of what we think strategy should do, is like, oh, strategy wins and creates our ideal end state or whatever. And instead of thinking about that, it's like, how do we, you know, we can still have identifiable goals and say, hey, this is how we know the situation has become a little more advantageous for us. Yeah. We can still set our targets for what we're trying to do, and a vision of success being a slightly better world or something like that. And I think that thinking in that way helps. Like, the strategy is not going to be the end all of the situation here. The battle's not going to end everything, but it's like, okay, we're going to set ourselves up for a better situation than we would have had otherwise. And that's really all we can do. And that should be the point of what we're striving for. Cause I think there might be an idea of like, oh, we're striving for this big thing. We didn't get it. So now what, you know, and it's kind of, we'll strive for another big thing, or we'll just try harder. We didn't build the Afghan army this year. Well, now, hey, this next year, we're really going to do it, right? We're going to try harder. We're
going to build the hell out of it. We're going to make S-fabs and go build them. Yeah. Well, and then it goes, and I think that goes back to the point, like, A, there needs to be realistic policy goals, you know. There also needs to be that. I really do believe, like, if you're doing strategy correctly, there's the goal, right, aspirational, but then there's the levels of sub-optimization that are inherent in anything, right? Because I think entropy is, you know, crosses the board as it relates to everything, and everything you try and do, there's some degree of entropy, right? That's, you're always pushing to disorder, and you're always having to push yourself and whatever it is you're trying to do away from disorder. And that's why we train armies. That's why we do recruiting, right? There's all these things. That I think is like the main takeaway. Whatever this goal is, you're really going to be hitting somewhere down here. And it's on a scale of like how many factors are actually competing against your ability and how unrealistic mm-hmm. are your goals as it relates to that. There was one last thing I was going to ask you or say based off something you said, and I lost it.
Oh, well, that happens to me in class all the time. I'm like, oh, hey, I was going to say something. I'm just standing in front of the
student. It was profound,
kind of
staring, too.
Staring at them, and it doesn't always work out.
All right. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I think down the road I would like to reboot this conversation because I think mm-hmm. we've uncovered a couple things that we could keep talking about for sure. Maybe like a joint, what is it, like a Family Feud type review of Capital Nolan's The Allure of Battle. You know, you pick your team and I'll pick mine and then we can come in and throw down or something.
Does that mean I have to actually finish reading the book, I guess?
You don't have to, but it helps. Essentially, if you know the first two chapters and just apply that across history, that gets you to today. And I'm all on board. I think it's terrific. But that's also probably because I've participated in so many indecisive wars on my own side. Yeah. So I'm looking for fault instead of looking to clap somebody on the back.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you, Jeff. I know it's getting early. And it's actually like normal time there. So I'll let you get back to your day. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me. Had a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.